On the 28th of August 1963, Martin Luther King gave a speech that's best remembered for the refrain, "I Have a Dream." 50 years on, Gary Young tells the story behind the speech and explores its impact today in God's Trombone, Remembering King's Dream.
I got up early in the morning and walked around, and it looked pretty dead. But then about 9 or 9:30, people started coming in. And they started coming in by bus from down south, and they started coming in by train from north and south. It was a very peaceful group. Everybody was singing. They sat together under the trees and by the reflecting pool.
We still have, at least hundreds of people with their feet dangling in the pool, cooling off, but as yet, no splashes.
This will be our final selection from the folk singing group, and we ask that all of you within the sound of their voices join in and express your feelings. This is John Baez, Bob...
People have been traveling all night to get to the march, and they've been settled in, and the sun is hot and it's humid.
Then there had been a morning program at the Washington Monument, and then the march itself to the Lincoln Memorial, and then a long, long afternoon program of music and speeches.
Most of the people in this country now are ready to do whatever it takes in a non-violent and religious and righteous way to be free.
There are people who are definitely turning back to Union Station to get on the trains, the buses to go home. Before King speaks, Mahalia Jackson sings.
That really roused a lot of people. And then there was one more speaker before King got there. So it was kind of a mixture of exhaustion and anticipation and excitement and a sense of kind of puzzlement of what's going to come of this whole day. How's it all going to end? What's it all going to mean in the long term?
Then A. Philip Randolph says, "Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the moment we have all been waiting for.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr."
My name is Dr. Clarence B. Jones. I work with him as his political advisor, personal lawyer, and draft speechwriter.
Did you know, as soon as he left the podium, free at last, thank God Almighty, free at last, did you think 50 years on we would still be talking about that speech? You saw him speak many times.
I didn't think that way 50 years on, but I did have this feeling. The speech itself, qua speech, as a speech, it was a good speech. But substantively, it was not necessarily his greatest speech. It was just something happened. This is that he had been taken over by some powerful, cosmic force, spiritual power. It was a result of the feedback between the speaker, Dr. King, and the audience and the place. I think so many things intangibly began to come together at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial, at this beautiful day.
Martin Luther King's speech at the March on Washington is America's favorite, rivaled in the public's affection only by Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. But in 1963 alone, King delivered around 350 speeches. Nine others gave speeches from the podium that day, and many more speeches have been given on civil rights. So what is it about this speech that's made it so iconic? It It's a speech that's been embraced by both Tea Party icon Glenn Beck and the nation's first black president, Barack Obama. It's known primarily by its signature refrain, "I Have a Dream," words that have appeared everywhere from the demonstrations in China's Tiananmen Square to the partition wall in the occupied West Bank. And yet, despite its popularity, relatively few people today actually know the speech beyond a few choice lines. So how do we remember it? Why do we remember it? And does the way we remember it say as much about us today as it does about those events 50 years ago? First of all, to grasp its lasting appeal and modern significance, it's important to understand not just the text of the speech, but the context in which it was delivered. By all accounts, it was an extraordinary day. Now, demonstrations in Washington, D.C. are commonplace. But the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was the first major political demonstration to descend on the Capitol. The media watched with fascination.
Incidentally, those who haven't eaten lunch down here already might as well forget it, because there's not enough room now to take the cellophane off a peanut butter sandwich.
Do you mean literally that they're jammed that close together?
They're packed in. If somebody fainted, he wouldn't hit the ground.
Has anybody actually been dunked in the reflecting pool yet?
Well, from our vantage point, as they say, we haven't seen anything of that.
The authorities literally policed this unprecedented event like a military operation. The FBI even installed a cutoff switch on the mic in case an insurgent group took control. The plan was to play gospel star Mahalia Jackson singing "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands" to calm the crowd. In the end, none of that was necessary.
Well, I think you could say it was as if they were perhaps on a picnic. That's the best description of it, at least where I am. As I said, we're right near these shady elms.
But the social calm of the day belied the political upheaval of the era.
It would be sort of like if right now in the Arab Spring, somebody made a speech that summarized what this whole period of social change is all about, it would have a similar impact.
Andrew Young went on to become mayor of Atlanta and the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. In 1963, he was one of King's closest advisors. Had most Americans even heard him speak at that stage?
Most of the black community had. He had been on the campaign trail since 1955, but he was not well understood.
Rioting raged for more than 3 hours after bomb attacks on an integrated motel and on the home of a Negro leader whose comment was, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do."
But the nation would get a clearer idea of what King was about in the spring of 1963, a few months before the march, when the issue of civil rights was propelled to the forefront of the national conversation by events in Birmingham, Alabama.
Became ugliest when Alabama state patrolmen, armed with carbines and automatic shotguns, moved in to take over from the Birmingham City Police.
Toward the end of May, we actually reached a settlement in Birmingham. All we wanted was for people to be able to work where they shopped, to take down the signs that said black water and white water. There's no such thing as black water and white water. There's water.
So coming off of Birmingham then, and going into the march and the speech, King was on a high.
He was, very much. But so were the kids. They said, now that we've settled Birmingham, let's head on to Washington and desegregate the whole nation.
From that point on, support for the march grew quickly among the various strands of the civil rights movement. As the day approached, everyone knew it would be big. All three networks decided to cover some part of the march at a time when television was just realizing its true power. It was the biggest platform the movement had been given so far, and among the various factions, there was an undignified scramble for the limelight.
There was a move to formalize that each speaker would have 5 minutes and Dr. King was going to be somewhere in the middle.
Mm.
I asked him, tell me. I said, I assume everybody here has heard Dr. King speak. Oh, yeah, yes, yes, yes. I said, well, are you sure that you want to follow him? And there was a sort of dead silence. And then Nate Phillip Randolph, in his statesmanlike, he says, well, I believe that Brother Jones has a point there, and I think it would be appropriate to have Martin be the last speaker. And it was only by the force of his personality and his stature that that occurred.
My name is Drew Hansen. My book is called The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Speech That Inspired a Nation.
I mean, I understand, Drew, that the night before the speech, Wyatt T. Walker says to him, "Don't do the I Have a Dream." You know, it's trite and it's a cliche, you know.
Yeah, that's right. King was working with Wyatt Walker, who was trying to put together some versions of what King could say. Andrew Young stopped by at some point that night to see how things were going.
I was in and out of the hotel, but he used to tell me that you have good ideas, but you don't use enough adjectives. You've got to write a little more poetically. And if you look at the copies of the speeches that he wrote, quite often he scratched out a word, five or six times, trying to get not only the right word, but the right rhythm.
Right.
He said in a phone conversation that the FBI wiretapped a few days before the speech that he wanted to do something that was sort of like a Gettysburg Address. I think he was looking to get as much input as he could. Earlier, King had asked Clarence Jones and Stanley Levison, another advisor, to put together a draft of a speech.
We talked about the fact that he should consider giving an address which sort of positioned the event in the moment of history, it being an inspirational validation of the nonviolent civil rights demonstration movement up until that date. So when I was in Washington at the Willard Hotel, when he was staying on the night before, I had already had drafted a kind of summary of our discussions we had on a yellow sheet of paper.
So he gathers his aides together in the lobby of the Willard Hotel, and they start firing ideas at him. One wants him to talk about jobs. Another wants him to talk about housing discrimination. And finally, King says, "My brothers, I understand. I appreciate all the suggestions. Now let me go and counsel with the Lord." So he goes up to his room at the hotel and spends the whole night writing the speech out in longhand. And he finishes at about 4 a.m, and it's a speech that most conspicuously does not have the words, "I have a dream," in it.
It's around 3 o'clock in the afternoon on what had been a sweltering day in D.C. The organizers had originally hoped for 100,000 people, but more than twice as many had actually shown up. King was 16th on an official program that included the national anthem, the invocation, a prayer, a tribute to women, 2 sets of songs, and 9 other speakers. He starts his speech off slowly. Audiobooks run at about 150 to 160 words a minute. King speaks at half that pace.
50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation.
Making that connection with Abraham Lincoln, it was at the Lincoln Memorial, put it in an all-American context. And he was saying to people, even though we had been brought here as slaves, we had built America. We are America. Our goals are for America to be the America that is promised in our Constitution and its preamble.
He makes it clear that there's more to freedom for the former slaves than simply the breaking of chains, that real equality will mean not just civil rights, but economic empowerment. This was, after all, the March on Washington for jobs and freedom.
The life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination 100 years later.
King starts to find his stride.
America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
I mean, I see and hear the audience reaction to him. Yes, Lord, I hear all that.
Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy.
Well, Speak, Doctor, speak.
Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time.
Polls at the time revealed that white Americans believed the civil rights movement was pushing for too much change too quickly. King insisted the nation must seize the moment, using a phrase picked up by Barack Obama.
We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now.
10 minutes in, and King, reaching the end of his prepared text, is starting to wind up.
Mahalia Jackson, she was sitting on the platform, on the podium. She shouted to him as he was reading from his prepared text, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And I saw him look at her and acknowledge. He slowed down a little. And then she shouted again, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And he took the written text, moved it to the left side of the podium, grabbed the podium and looked up out at all of those more than 250,000 people. I said, "This is the stance of a Baptist preacher now." I said, he's getting ready to preach. And I said, "You know, these people out there don't know it, but they're about ready to go to church."
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
Yeah, yeah. we speak about him as a civil rights leader, which he used to bristle at a lot. But in fact, he was a minister of the gospel.
The tradition of African-American Baptist preaching demands the versatility to respond to a crowd at any given moment. It's an interactive engagement in which the sermon is always a work in progress, drafted by the preacher and then crafted with the congregation.
"I Have a Dream," he'd used in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. He'd used it in Albany, Georgia. He'd used it in Birmingham. But it wasn't in his prepared speech at the march. And because he was trained as a preacher and able to improvise on the fly, he was able to reach back and insert that long run into the speech, even though he hadn't intended to do it in the first place. King, from a very early age, was studying how to structure a sermon, how to use repeated words and phrases to get a reaction from the audience. If you listen to politicians today who use a repeated word or a phrase, they always pause in the wrong place. I mean, if they were delivering "I Have a Dream," they would say, "I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up to live up the true meaning of its creed." Pause. "I have a dream that one day my four little children will sit down together with white children." Pause. King pauses right after the repeated phrase. So he says, I have a dream. Pause.
"That my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Pause. Because the audience then has a natural break. I mean, that's what you're cheering for. You're cheering for the propulsion of the repeated phrase that goes on instead of at the end of the sentence.
King was one of what Harlem Renaissance intellectual James Weldon Johnson called God's trombones. Part of that elite core of Black American leadership under segregation and slavery, for whom the pulpit and the podium were often interchangeable. Since the church was one of the few places where slaves could organize autonomously, the preacher's role often blended the religious with the political. They were the first of the slaves to learn to read, Johnson explains, and their reading was confined to the Bible. The old-time Negro preacher was above all an orator, wrote Johnson, and in good measure an actor. He knew the secret of oratory, that at bottom it's a progression of rhythmic words more than anything else. He was a master of all the modes of eloquence. He had the power to sweep his hearers before him, and so himself was often swept away. At such times, continued Johnson, his language was not prose, but poetry.
"We will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day."
Within a year, Kennedy was assassinated, Cassius Clay had changed his name to Muhammad Ali, and the Civil Rights Act was passed. The epicenter of black politics moved from the rural South to the urban North, and the message from integration to black power. What King provided in that moment was a sense of both the perils and the possibilities to come. There was something in that speech for everybody. Both timely and timeless, it managed to both appeal to its immediate audience and to history.
When King and the other leaders of the march show up at the White House to meet the president, John Kennedy approaches King. He extends his arm forward for a handshake, and he says to King, "I have a dream." And when Kennedy was watching that speech earlier in the day, when King was doing that section, Kennedy turns to his aide and says, "Damn, he's good." You know, it was not lost on people this day.
But for the most part, the national debate moves on. The civil rights activists were throwing themselves into other protests. There was the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act coming up before Congress in the next several years. People were focused on other things.
King also moved on, taking on issues of poverty and the Vietnam War. And as he did so, his public standing suffered. At the time of the speech, Americans were evenly divided about whether they approved of him or not. 3 years later, twice as many Americans had an unfavorable opinion of him as a favorable one. And by the time he was assassinated in 1968, he cut a marginalized figure. Ironically, only once he was dead was his speech resurrected.
I think it seemed fitting to a lot of people that someone who had such a prophetic way about him, and obviously a black Baptist minister as well, would be memorialized with this poetic, powerful image of a dream.
Asked in 2008 whether they thought the speech was relevant to people of their generation, 68% of Americans said yes, and only 4% weren't familiar with it.
My name is Charlie Eichner. We hear so much of the "I Have a Dream" passage, which is so uplifting. It's sometimes hard to remember just how dire things could have gotten at that moment.
Charles, in your book, Nobody Turned Me Around, it's interesting that you describe the speech as an indictment, in part, not least because 50 years on, it's not really consumed as an indictment, is it? It's consumed as a America and Technicolor, you know, we can do anything kind of speech, as opposed to a kind of damning critique of slavery and post-segregation.
Absolutely.
World.
When people hear that loop, that kind of constant loop, "I have a dream, I have a dream," you know, in all of our lives, people can take all kinds of things from us. They can take our rights, they can take our property, they can take our jobs, they can take our family, they can take all kinds of things from us, but they can't take away our dream. And as long as we have a dream, we can move forward and we can define our own journey ahead.
But are there politics involved in this, in what America chooses to remember? Because to remember King as the man who gave the Riverside speech against the Vietnam War would demand engaging with militarism, or to remember him as the leader of the Poor People's Campaign would demand engaging with poverty. And those are issues that are unresolved, as opposed to segregation, codified segregation, which nobody's seriously calling for a return for. Is that part of what's going on with the public memory of that speech?
Oh, absolutely, both then and now. The end of the speech is mostly about an end to the Jim Crow system of segregation in the South. And remembering King through that speech allows us to congratulate ourselves as a nation on how far we've come without necessarily reminding ourselves of the last several years of King's career, where he is very much focused on a lot of issues that are still very much matters of live political controversy in America, even today.
It's arguably because these issues are so live that they've been effectively erased from King's myth. To remember the whole man and a whole speech would be to engage with thorny problems like poverty or war that wouldn't raise King above the fray, but very much insert him into it. But getting rid of official segregation was the last great moral victory the country can claim, for which there's still a consensus. To remember King as the man who articulated that victory makes him a shared national hero, even in the age of Obama and the Tea Party. so people with radically conflicting views about the nation's landscape can still claim the speech and the speaker as their own. Progressives hail it as an indictment against American racism. Conservatives stress the claim that race shouldn't matter in order to argue that racism's legacy should no longer be taken into account. In short, people remember and forget the parts of the speech that don't fit their worldview. Nonetheless, eloquent, poetic, and unapologetic, the speech manages to express its patriotism by pointing out how the nation has failed to live up to its ideals. It lays bare the nation's bigotries while laying out a vision for a colorblind future. It prescribes no program or policy, but insists on principle and morality. All that in the vernacular of the black church, starting with Lincoln and ending with the Negro spiritual.
And singing the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
God's Trombone, Remembering King's Dream, was presented by Gary Young, produced by Peggy Sutton, and is a Something Else production.